So thank you all so much for coming. I'd like to thank our sponsors who made this event possible, and that's the Political Science Department here at Fordham Hall, the Lang Center for Civic and Social Responsibility, and the Global Affairs Series. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Osman Balkan. I teach in the Political Science Department here, and it's an honor to welcome Peter Andreas back to Swarthmore. Peter was a political science major and also a sociology anthropology minor who graduated in 1987. I went and tried to look up his student transcripts and on the faculty services website, but unfortunately they were not available, so rest assured, students, in 20 years, 30 years, no one will know what you did here. It's lost records. So once you get out of this place, it's all secret. But Peter has gone on to do great things since his time at Swarthmore. He earned his PhD in political science from Cornell and currently teaches at Brown University, where he has a joint appointment as the John Hay Professor of International Studies and Political Science in the Department of Political Science and at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. He's held fellowships at Harvard, at the Brookings Institute, and at the SSRC MacArthur Foundation. And Professor Andreas is a leading scholar in the field of international relations and the author of 10 books. These include, most recently, Rebel Mother, which is a fascinating memoir about his childhood, published in 2017. Smuggler Nation, How Illicit Trade Made America, published by Oxford Press in 2013. One of my favorites, Border Games, Policing the U.S.-Mexico Divide, a book which has become a classic in border studies and whose second edition appeared in 2009 with Cornell Press. His articles have been published in leading journals in our field, including International Security, International Studies Quarterly, and Perspectives on Politics. And he's also written many op-eds and public-facing pieces in outlets such as Foreign Affairs, Harper's, The Nation, and The Washington Post. Professor Andreas is currently working on a new book about the relationship between drugs and warfare, entitled Killer High, A History of War and Six Drugs, which he'll be talking to us about today. So please join me in welcoming Professor Peter Andreas.
Thank you, Asmal, for that generous and kind introduction. It's fabulous to be back. I have not actually given a talk at Swarthmore. It's been over 30 years, and I've been back for reunions, but I've actually never seen the place in action, meaning you guys, you know, running around the campus and reminding me of what it was like back in the day. It's surreal to see some of my professors actually here as well. So they can attest that I actually went here, even though my grades are not appropriate. But back then, I don't know if it's still the same, I was in the honors program, and we didn't actually get grades. It was like, you know, maybe eight, you know, some kind of system where you all get graded at the very end of your senior year. It was pretty intensive, actually. I want to tell you about my current book project. It's on the history of the relationship between war and drugs. Osman said the title is Killer High. That's not my title. That's the title that they're imposing on me. They may win that battle, but I think it's a little too cute. Killer High, History of War and Six Drugs. But for the talk purposes, this is what the book's about. This is what the talk is about. And so basically, I've taken a historical turn in my research and writing in recent years. I'm really a closet historian at this point, though my historian colleagues probably would not recognize me as a real historian. And what I do in this book is I trace from ancient times to the present, but especially the last 500 years, especially, the relationship, as you'll see, a complicated and fascinating relationship between warfare and psychoactive substances. And so I show its variation across place, time, and psychoactive substance. And really, you know, one takeaway is how drugs, in an important way, made war, and war in turn shaped drugs and made drugs as well. So it's this interactive relationship over time, across place, and across drugs. And there are links to earlier work, even though it's not always historical. Drug War Politics. My first book, I was a secondary author. You'll be the co-author with my undergraduate thesis advisor, Ken Sharp, who many of you, some of you anyway, have had in class, or maybe still having in class. I believe it's his last semester here. I'm sad he's not here right now. And also with another, Eva Bertram, another Swarthmore grad. Border Games, already mentioned. Policing the Globe about the internationalization of crime control, a book about the siege of Sarajevo, Blue Helmets and Black Markets, and then more recently, Smuggler Nations, a history of the United States through the lens of smuggling. It's partly through these books that I became interested in this topic, but this is the first project of mine where I've really focused on drugs since, well, now more than 20 years, since Drug War Politics. So I'm coming full circle, but much more historical, and actually with a clear connection to issues of warfare. What's the added value? So what? You have to ask, you know, why sit here and listen to this lecture? Why write a book about this? Why bother killing some trees to publish it? You know, well, I would suggest it helps us answer questions about war that we otherwise can't answer if we do not include issues of drugs. So I'll get into more of that in the substance of the talk, but just, you know, big questions like, you know, what sustained French troop morale in the trenches of, you know, World War I? How was morale kept up in London during the Battle of Britain? How did the Japanese pay for their invasion and occupation of China? How did kamikaze pilots do what they did? Similarly, ask key questions about drugs. How does China in the 19th century become the world's largest, you know, addicted population? Or more benignly, how does Coca-Cola, which is a drug actually, caffeinated drug, become the world's most popular soft drink? These are wide-ranging questions across time and place and drug that you can't answer without including issues of war. So it's, in some ways, think about it this way. It's a lens to look at the history of war in a different way, and a history of war, and basically the history of war in a different way than the others, and a history of drugs in a way that you otherwise wouldn't look at. Another way to put it is it's a military history told through the lens of drugs, and drug history told through the lens of military history. Now, this is not exactly a hot topic in political science, certainly, and there's bits and pieces of this story out there. In fact, I'll tell you in a second, that's what my book is mostly about, is connecting the dots. But for the most part, this story is marginalized, not just in political science, but across the social sciences, and even, frankly, in history. It's not marginal world politics. It's actually, as I'll hopefully convince you, it's been essential world politics. And it's certainly a big part of some current policy debates over, you know, what to do about the Taliban. Mm-hmm. You know, basically drug, you know, opium-funded insurgents in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Or you know, the FARC guerrillas in Colombia, cocaine finance, right? But what I want to suggest is, you know, part of the motivation is to open up what I find is a fairly narrow and distorted public debate. So there's an academic motivation, which is, you know, it's marginalized, but it's important in the real world. And there's a kind of narrowness and distorted aspect to the public policy debate over these issues. As some of you know, there's an overwhelmingly large literature on the history of the war. No surprise, right? There's also a sizable, though much smaller, literature on the history of drugs. What's fascinating is that those two literatures rarely intersect. They don't really speak to each other. Those historians don't read each other's stuff. You get snippets of it here and there. But for the most part, the war literature and the drug literature are divorced. And so one of the things to do is to bring these together. Also, the big picture story is mostly missing, even in those accounts that put it front and center. So you might have a book on opium and counterinsurgency in Southeast Asia. You'll have a book about amphetamines in World War II. You'll have a book about the drug wars in Mexico today, right? You get my very geographically focused, temporally focused, specific drug focused. But the big picture narrative is mostly still missing. And in fact, most accounts, and this includes me until now, mostly privileging illegal drugs and stateless actors. My initial entree into this topic back in the 90s with Ken Sharp, illegal drugs, the war on drugs, stateless actors, right? Narco insurgents, narco terrorists, drug cartels. The image you get from these kind of terms and the most of the writing about drugs and war is about weakening states, non-state threats, and so on, whether it's, you know, insurgents, terrorists, or traffickers, right? And it's mostly a brackets history. History starts in after the end of the Cold War. So, as a corrective to this, there's a glossing over of legal drugs, there's a glossing over of longer history, and there's a glossing over of the role of state. And so I try to sort of bring these things in more front and center. My own bias is to privilege illegal drugs, as I already mentioned. But if you actually look at the historical record, there's absolutely no reason to privilege illegal drugs when you're looking at the relationship between war and drugs. You have to be agnostic about the importance of different drugs when you're looking at the historical record. So one thing you do is you actually make this a combined story of legal and illegal. Also, the overall takeaway is that, yes, the drugs war relationship has undermined states, threatened them, sometimes feel under siege by drug cartels and narco insurgents and so on. But the larger historical story here is, frankly, of empowering states. Statecraft, using drugs to pursue strategic interests. Even when it doesn't work out, might have perverse consequences, but again, this is a corrective of sorts. The other thing I want to do in this book is just actually tell us in simple, clear form, what exactly is the relationship between drugs and war? Because most people think about one dimension of the relationship and forget about the others. And so in a second, I'm actually going to unpack it systematically, sort of like all the different dimensions of the relationship. And those dimensions vary dramatically across different drugs, different places, different wars. And so there's hopefully a contribution just by actually critically unpacking what those dimensions are and push back against a privileging of certain dimensions. So I haven't talked about specific drugs yet. But I did say I want to bring in both legal and illegal drugs. Alcohol's a drug. It's the world's most important drug. Well, caffeine actually is. But alcohol is the oldest drug. It's the largest consumption drug, both on and off the battlefield. Nicotine in the form of tobacco, more recent world history, but hugely important, often on the battlefield. Caffeine, we don't think of it as a drug, but it's an important drug. I wouldn't be talking to you right now if I had, my 10 doses of caffeine. I'm overdosed on caffeine at this point today. But what I mean by caffeine, I mean mostly coffee and tea. But I actually also mean caffeinated beverages such as Coca-Cola in particular. Opium, often people immediately think, drugs? What are they? Opium, yes. The opium wars, after all, right? Yes, that's an important part of our story. It's not the only part. It's derived as morphine and heroin. Amphetamines comes late. This is a 20th century story. This is about the industrialization of the relationship between war and psychoactive substances. So it's a World War II story up to the present. Coca and cocaine, that's primarily the driver of the militarization of today's drug war. Notice what I haven't talked about or mentioned? Cannabis. Hallucinogens. Hallucinogens are a niche drug. Yes, they may have battlefield applications in certain cultures at certain times and places, but for the most part, These are not very useful drugs. Tripping out on mushrooms is not going to win you very many wars. And frankly, there's not a history of taxing them by states to generate drug, revenue. Cannabis, though, is the big surprise. When I first started this project, I thought, wow, the world's most important illicit drug, cannabis, has to be part of the story. Has to be. Reading the historical literature, yeah, sure, it's here and there in the drug story, but it's remarkably less important than all these others. So the subtitle of the book is A History of War in Six Drugs, not Seven. I thought about adding a chapter on cannabis, but it would have been kind of a weak chapter. Frankly, the purpose of the chapter would have been to kind of explain the puzzle of cannabis not being as prominent as the others. And in fact, the most important role of cannabis historically in relation to drugs is as a fiber for rope for naval purposes, not for actually using as a psychoactive substance. And the purpose of my book is about psychoactive substance, so that kind of takes it out of contention. Now, sure, plenty of American GIs smoked dope in Vietnam, and actually Napoleon's troops brought hash back with them from Egypt and introduced it to France, but it's actually, believe it or not, at the end of the day, less important than these other drugs. So I mentioned the importance of, just as a basic elementary thing, unpacking the relationship, showing its core dimensions. Well, while on drugs, this is literally the use of drugs, psychoactive substances, by combatants, but not just by combatants, but by civilians in wartime itself, the home front and the war front. Next one's very different, war through drugs, right? Nothing to do with actually using drugs for the business of war, it's actually using drugs to finance war to weaken the enemy. They're both about the relationship between drugs and war, but they're fundamentally different, right? In fact, there's actually a whole book, War While on Drugs, but the author doesn't talk about any of these other dimensions. War for drugs, very different, though actually overlap sometimes with through drugs. Sometimes you use drug revenue to then take over drug markets. The classic example, of course, war for drugs are the opium wars. Opium One, Britain won the war, Opium One. War against drugs, this is what we're most familiar with. This is what some people, anyway, think the book's about when they hear about it. In fact, I saw the ad for this talk, had a picture of Narcos, and said, oh, it must be the war on drugs. And yes, my first book was called Drug War Politics, and that's how I got into this issue. But frankly, that's only one small piece of the story. It's hugely important today, what's going on in Mexico. The number of deaths in Mexico rivals and actually surpasses most civil wars. Over 100,000 deaths in the last decade in Mexico. I mean literally here, though. I don't mean war as metaphor, war on drugs. When it started, Nixon coined the phrase, it was metaphor. We weren't sending in the military yet. After the Cold War, it started in the 80s, but really revved up after the Cold War, actually using instruments of war to suppress drugs. Or to attack rivals in the name of drug suppression. We can talk more about that. We see it, playing out today all over the world, but especially right next door in Mexico. Last but not least, drugs after war. There's winners and losers from war. Well, guess what? Drugs are amongst the biggest winners and losers from war. Some drugs rise and some decline based on outcomes of war. And I will give you some illustrations of that in a second. So, how well you can see this. I'm always skeptical of PowerPoint slides with too much information on them in tiny print, but hopefully you can, this is kind of, you don't need to read the book, just see this, right? I mean, basically, the dimensions of the drug war relationship, their relevance across drugs, and what you basically show is, well, war while on drugs varies across drug. So it's really important in alcohol and tobacco and caffeine, but it's actually more moderate in the case of opium. It's very high in the case of amphetamines, actually low in the case of cocaine. Cannabis is only on the chart as a comparison. Remember I told you cannabis turns out to be. Notice that cannabis doesn't score high in any category, either low or moderate. This is not scientifically systematic. This is my reading, having read as much as I possibly could about the history of both drugs and war, and putting, synthesizing it, and coming up with this. Some people might quibble with, you know, whether it's low or moderate, but I think most people, if they did that homework, they would agree with this characterization. So it's fascinating. So amphetamines, hugely important, wore while on drugs. But you know what? Not that important as a funder of war compared to, say, the history of alcohol or tobacco. Anyway, you get my point. So it varies across drug, and then the dimensions vary a great deal as well. And now it's interesting, drugs after, here's not a lot of variation. All the core six drugs are hugely impacted by the aftermath of war, except actually cannabis, which again is not a chapter in the book. War against drugs, and literally I mean war, I don't mean metaphor. I mean using military personnel, technologies, doctrines, instruments, and so on. And guess what? The only one that, opium scores high, cocaine actually scores the highest of all if you really tell the story. The militarization of the war on drugs is really a story of the militarization of the war on cocaine. And it's really just the last couple decades. Anyway, let me go on and actually give you some empirical examples of stories. Why talk to you about the American Revolution? Other than the fact that you're in the United States of America, this place wouldn't exist the way it does if it wasn't for the American Revolution. But why do I pick this case to illustrate these various dimensions? Because it turns out that it's one conflict that actually captures all of the dimensions in one conflict. I have to think about this once more, but it captures all the dimensions better than any other conflict I've found. So, you know, some wars, it's, you know, funded by war, but not use of drugs during war. Anyway, in the American Revolution, we have all five of those dimensions that I just outlined for you. So, how are we doing on time?
Good. 20.
Great. All right. Perfect. So let's talk about the outbreak of the American Revolution. First of all, where are they plotting the revolution? It's not in churches, or in schools, or in private homes, or on college campuses. It's in taverns. So it's not the drug itself, alcohol, but the place where it's served that provides the meeting place. And, you know, a tavern is where the Declaration of Independence is written. A tavern is a place where the Declaration of Independence is read. A tavern is where, you know, the famous taverns in Boston is where they plotted the Boston Tea Party. There's actually an interesting literature just on taverns. So I use that and make it part of the story, right? There's also a very interesting story that if I had more time I'd go into the details about rum in the revolution. And this, there is more detail in my book, Smuggler Nation. Basically, our very founding story is a smuggling story in that the New England colonies, not Pennsylvania, where I'm from, Rhode Island in particular, frankly, and Massachusetts, dependent on rum exports. It's the most important export. For rum, you need molasses. There's no way you can legally import as much molasses as you want from the British West Indies. So you smuggle it in from the French West Indies. How do we know this? Because we know how much rum is produced by these New England distilleries. They're perfectly legal distilleries. And we know that the amount of legally imported molasses does not come anywhere close to being able to produce that much rum. So there's a big mystery there. Well, it's made up by the black market. It's made up by smuggling. It's not part of our story of drugs and war, though, until the British cracked down on this trade. They not just cracked down on this trade, they turned the British Royal Navy into the customs force. This is truly the militarization of the war on drugs in a way that we don't even have today in the United States. Right? They turned the world's most powerful navy to stop a smuggling business. And the smugglers not only balked and pushed back, they rebelled violently. right? So we look at what's going on in Mexico, it is awful, it's terrible, and the deaths are extraordinary. For the most part, traffickers today want to be left alone, not take over the state in terms of actually an independent country. In this case, it actually contributed to the outbreak of the American Revolution itself. Tobacco interests as well. Not a smuggling story, but a heavily constrained trade. They could only trade with England. These were heavily indebted tobacco farmers and tobacco interests. Tea? Well, yes, it's you know, caffeine, and we all know about the Boston Tea Party. I don't need to tell you that story. What's fascinating is how many of the signers of the Declaration of Independence had some kind of interest in distilling and in tobacco. Right? They knew they'd be better off if they could call the shots themselves, so they were perfectly fine trying to rebel. However, that raises a real puzzle. How did this ragtag force think it could actually win against the world's most powerful military? Well, today we talk about conflict commodities, cocaine, or we talk about blood diamonds in Africa as funding rebels. Well, what funded our rebels? Tobacco was pretty important. In fact, Benjamin Franklin went to France and negotiated a pretty good deal. Basically put tobacco down as collateral for a French loan and helped pay for the war. The British were so outraged that they went on a burning spree to burn down tobacco fields in Virginia. Some of them, they knew they were Thomas Jefferson's fields. This was a classic conflict commodity. Rum, though, too, interestingly, the soldiers on both sides received rum rations to keep them going. Today it seems crazy, rum rations to soldiers. The British actually kept the rum ration going in the British Navy until the 1970s. But anyway, most countries, U.S. gave that up in the 1830s. Whiskey ration was wiped out. After the war, what explains the fact that rum, the most, you know, the alcoholic heart, the spirit of choice in the colonies, switched to whiskey? Well, lots of interesting reasons. One is rum was associated with, and that's a British drink. We're now a newly independent country. We're going to show our independence. Our identity as a nation is built about not being British. So that pushes shift from rum to whiskey. But there's also more material considerations. It's now more expensive to import the raw material for rum, whereas you can actually produce whiskey from corn in the rapidly expanding West. Now that you have met the British, can no longer tell you can't move west, so now there's excess corn production, and so there's whiskey distilleries spring up all over in western Pennsylvania. I'll get to that in a second. So the country switches from rum to whiskey. That's a legacy, that's a consequence of the war. But similarly, more benignly, tea to coffee. We're a coffee-drinking country for the most part. Have been for a long time, but before the revolution, it was all about tea. Not all, but mostly. Switch to coffee. Why? Partly tea's more expensive. Coffee also becomes more accessible from more nearby sources, especially after countries in Latin America become independent and Brazil starts producing this stuff in the early 19th century. Interestingly, the very rebellion against the crown, which is the imposition of taxes on, in this case, previously with the rum trade through the molasses taxes, now a new government says, you know what, we were all against taxes then, but now we're for them. Now we actually need some minimal amount of revenue to keep the federal government going. So we're going to impose a modest tax on whiskey production. And Western Pennsylvania distillers rebel. And so Hamilton and George Washington quickly formed a large militia and squashed it fairly quickly and easily. But it's fascinating that the whiskey rebellion is actually implicated in the building of the new American state. Some people who were extremely skeptical of any taxes whatsoever, when the whiskey rebellion started, they suddenly realized, you know what, we kind of knew the standing army. So John Brown, one of the founders of my university, he was one of the most outspoken critics of paying assent to the federal government. Rhode Island, I think, was one of the last states to actually go along with new taxes. After the Whiskey Rebellion, John Brown woke up and said, we need some minimal amount of order. Any questions about any of this? Actually, no. I'm talking right now as if I'm in a lecture with students. No, we're going to have a Q&A right after the lecture. So sorry. I do this in lecture. I stop myself all the time and make sure you guys are okay, but I'm sure you're okay. Fast forward. We could take a lot of different, American Revolution was chosen because it captured all these different dimensions and actually multiple drugs. But, take the World War II, by far the most devastating war in human history. Sun Tzu once said, speed is the essence of war. He didn't mean what I mean. Fascinating, the book came out of this. I mean, basically using a German journalist wrote a book called Blitz. Norman Ohler. I'll tell you why that book is problematic, but frankly very useful for me at the same time. Basically, it shows that the Blitzkrieg was fueled by speed. They were producing millions of pills of methamphetamines called Pervitin, manufactured near Berlin, and doled out to the troops to keep them awake for days, and the retreating French and Belgians were just astonished at the sheer speed of the onslaught. They just couldn't put, there's a lot of things surprising about it, but one was literally the amount of terrain captured over a very short period of time, how fast they got to actually the French border. This is very hard to measure, actually, essential speed was in the speed of Blitzkrieg, but to actually ignore the fact that the troops were all drugged up is also problematic, right? Now, it's fascinating, this isn't in that book, Blitz. The Germans started, after a year or two of the war, they actually started, the dosages went down, and they became more concerned about the side effects of these drugs. But even as Germany was lowering dosages and stopped distributing as much, Allies were starting to distribute it in a big way. So the Brits, the Americans, were all now, especially air forces, on the drug, and the Japanese. And the Japanese, it wasn't just kamikaze pilots who were usually drugged up. So you can imagine, it's not surprising, right? But until you actually say it, the pilots were drugged. People don't think about it. It's no surprise when you're going on a suicide mission, it might be helped to have some drugs. But what's interesting is defense workers also receiving large quantities of drugs. Now here's a country that prior to World War II had a very little drug problems. It had actually been able to successfully insulate itself from the outside world while opium invaded nearby China. Suddenly, World War II, amphetamines, after World War II, stockpiles of the stuff are dumped on the civilian population. Japan actually has its first drug epidemic in history in the decade and a half after the war. And still to this day, amphetamines are the drug of choice, the illicit drug of choice, in Japan but also elsewhere. So who are the drug winners? Well, I just told you amphetamines basically made a big splash in East Asia in a way that they hadn't before. The American Armed Forces actually kept using amphetamines for decades. In fact, we're probably using them in Korea and in Vietnam at much higher dosages than they were in World War II. In fact, to this day, the Air Force still allocates tablets to long-distance pilots to use as needed. Caffeine, I don't just mean caffeine, I mean particular caffeine products. So instant coffee, you ever wonder why it became so popular? Well, you can imagine instant coffee being kind of useful on the front, right? So it really didn't take off as a mass-produced, mass-consumed drug until World War II. It was used in World War I, and then really took off in World War II, and then had staying power post-war. And Coca-Cola, I mean, it's the world's most famous, most successful caffeinated soft drink. How did Coca-Cola conquer the world after World War II? Not just because U.S. ended up in the war as the biggest power, that's obviously part of the story. No, it got a head start during the war. It was the privileged soda company that basically had bottling plants near the front lines, basically a monopoly, the U.S. government, so in France and elsewhere. So when the war ended, they were already positioned all over the world to take over local markets in a way that they would not have been if it had not been for World War II tobacco. Not just any tobacco, but American tobacco brands became the brand of choice. Marlboro has become the favorite brand of choice. And in fact, in post-war, immediate post-war, Germany, devastated economy, much of Europe, but especially Germany, cigarettes actually become money. This is a kind of currency for trading, the most reliable currency. American soldiers stationed in Germany right after the war in a privileged position. You can buy anything because they have the cigarettes to do it. The Marshall Plan, I forget the number, it's in the book. The amount of cigarettes that are part of the Marshall Plan is astonishing. And you think of it as, well, that's just cigarettes to make people happy. Well, yeah, but it's actually money. Those cigarettes, right after World War II, that's like a mint. This is currency. You trade it for food. And if you don't have a smoking habit, all the better. If you don't smoke the stuff, you use it to buy food and other things. All right. Some drugs lost also. We don't hear much today about legal cocaine. Well, before World War II, Japan, leading pharmaceutical companies were all producing legal cocaine based on coca plantations in, you know, Java, Indonesia. Peru had a legal raw cocaine export industry accessing, you know, Germany, where the refined, the final white powder would be refined by German pharmaceutical companies. Devastated by World War II. Basically, the American occupation of Japan and nearby areas that Japan had been growing coca completely wiped out legal cocaine, right? So the criminalization of cocaine, which the U.S. had actually wanted since early in the 20th century, the only thing that enabled it to actually globalize its preference for cocaine prohibition and physically exterminate legal cocaine was through World War II. Now, I've hopefully convinced you how important drugs are in the history of war and how important war is in the history of drugs. However, and in the book, this caveat is in the beginning of the book rather than at the end, but basically the real challenge here, and it's been the biggest, one of the biggest challenges of the project, is how do I bring drugs into the story of war without any of drugging the analysis? Like, everything ends up being about drugs, 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 and you end up blaming drugs for wars. And drugs kind of make you fuzzy-brained, frankly, so you got to be careful not to make the analysis fuzzy-brained. There's a contemporary literature, which I'm not citing, I don't want to insult people, but basically, you know, you get the impression that drugs are the source of war all over the world right now. It's more complicated than that. It facilitates, it's a tool, it's an instrument, but drugs have no agency of their own. And most importantly, if we look at the bigger historical sweep of things, states have been the biggest beneficiaries overall, and it's the legal drugs, not the illegal drugs, that have been the most important. What about the future? Where is this all headed? We don't have a lot of time. We can talk about it more in the Q&A. But, I mean, I hate to say it, but drug-free world is as unlikely as a war-free world. So you put those two realities together, and the drugs war relationship remains alive and well today, and I have no expectation that that's going to change anytime soon, but that doesn't mean it doesn't change. I mean, it doesn't change in some way. There's patterns of continuity and change. So, for example, governments, for the most part, are no longer as dependent, for example, on drug tax revenue as they once were historically, before national income taxes really became a core source of funding. And alcohol on the battlefield, it's just not as tolerated anymore. I mean, warfare is a much more complicated, sophisticated, expensive business, lots of machinery. If you screw up because you're even buzzed with alcohol, it costs lives and airplanes and so on. So the nature of warfare itself, mechanization and sophisticated, has made it less and less possible to be drunk on the job. Whereas at one point in history, drunk soldiers, they were always a mixed bag, frankly, but sometimes having them a little drunk numbed them and made them more useful. However, it doesn't mean they're not drunk. It's interesting. The amphetamines are still used more selectively. New drugs are being developed all the time. Painkillers, which I haven't talked about, have now also have sort of recreational purposes. So, you know, getting hooked on painkiller opiates. It's interesting. American veterans in Vietnam came back sometimes with heroin addictions. Now it's the Army cleaned up considerably after that. Now American veterans come back from Afghanistan and Iraq with opioid, with, you know, addicted to prescription opioids. Then, when they get cut off from their supply, they may actually turn to heroin because it's actually cheaper. So prescription opioids are actually a gateway drug, if you will, to heroin. Military scientists all over the world, key drug research is how to deal with sleep. So it's that same thing we saw in the Blitzkrieg, how to keep these soldiers awake for days. They're still at it, trying to perfect a drug that's not going to have the negative consequences, the addictive properties, but be able to keep you alert, give you that competitive edge over your enemy. It's not just the U.S. militaries. All over the world are busy coming up with the super drug to keep people awake longer with less negative consequences. Anyway, I will stop there and we can open up the discussion. Thank you.